So I've got a question for all the video game lovers out there. Are you seriously going to miss out on Alienware's biggest gaming sale of the year? I mean, these are Black Friday prices we're talking about, so it's not just another sale. I took a look, and this is some pretty big bang for your buck. You know, it's Alienware, with some of the most advanced engineering out there, with systems at the top of reviewers' lists. And what about a gift for yourself? Gift yourself a new Alienware 16 Area 51 gaming laptop. I mean, this thing's got performance at the absolute next level with Intel Core Ultra processors. And even better, you can get it during Black Friday. Plus, you can save on all kinds of displays and accessories, like the Alienware 27 4K QD OLED gaming monitor for ultimate visual fidelity. These really are incredible deals on PCs with otherworldly performance, so I'd visit alienware.com/deals soon and grab what you can before their biggest sale of the year goes dark. This week in Retronauts, it's the Miggity 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 Mac Daddies. Everyone, and welcome to episode, 99. It's way up there for Retronauts. I am your host for this week, Jeremy Parrish, and with me, it's a Retronauts East, so that means it's
Ben Jedwards
and
Ben Elgin.
Keep those two straight. One has a J and the other does not. Mm-hmm. And this week, we are going to continue the series that we kind of started with our first episode on 8-bit microcomputers and the games that go with them. This episode is brought to you by Audible, the audiobook service with more than 180,000 titles to choose from. Get a free audiobook and a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/game. Retronauts has been looking back at the Final Fantasy series lately in preparation for the series' upcoming 30th anniversary. One of my favorite Final Fantasy characters is Shadow's dog Interceptor from Final Fantasy VI. You can't control him, but as a dog, he's a bruiser in combat. When his companion Shadow takes a hit, Interceptor rushes into battle to counterattack. He's hardcore. But you know, I bet Interceptor would have been a lot more chill if Shadow had subscribed to BarkBox. Sure, that might have been a little tough since BarkBox is a monthly service that delivers dog treats to your door, and Shadow was a wandering nomadic ninja assassin. Also, BarkBox offers free shipping in the US, but not the World of Ruin. But BarkBox would have given Interceptor a fresh assortment of toys and edible treats with a different theme every month, sourced from a variety of local and small businesses, and customizable to his size, habits, and health needs. And if Interceptor hadn't liked a particular treat, he wouldn't have had to counterattack. BarkBox offers free replacements for unloved treats. If only Shadow had gone to getbarkbox.com/game, he could have signed up and gotten a free bonus month of service for subscribing. Ah well, you aren't a surly nomadic ninja who barely survives the apocalypse, though, so why not subscribe for your own canine pal? That's getbarkbox.com/game. So back a few months ago, we talked about the Apple II and its sort of legacy and its important role in the history of video gaming. This time around, what we're planning to do is follow up on that with the next phase of Apple's video game history, the Macintosh. Of course, the Macintosh was not designed as a gaming system. I don't think it was not designed as a gaming system, but once Steve Jobs got his hands on it, he was like, no games. Those are frivolous and dumb. And the system turned into a pretty neat gaming machine, sort of despite the mandate of its imperious commander, Steve Jobs.
Not going to keep people from making games, especially on when they're using it as a hobbyist machine.
If you build it, they will develop games. That's the rule of computing. Mm-hmm. Also porn, but we're going to talk about games.
That's porn not. That's your next podcast.
That's my
series.
Next Patreon goal.
Yeah.
Right. So anyway, I can say for myself, Mac gaming is not something I have a lot of experience with. It was something that I kind of saw from a distance and coveted, but Macintoshes were kind of expensive, and so they weren't really that easy for me to get a hold of. We had a few Macintoshes in some of our computer labs, and it wasn't until like 1993 that I got my own system and had sort of unfettered access to Macs. But this week we're going to talk about 80s gaming on Macintosh. I think that'll probably fill an entire episode because there's some really interesting games, some very innovative and unique games that were made for the system, again, sort of despite itself. And I feel like that's going to fill an hour and a half. So we'll see what happens. So to begin with, I'm curious, what history do you guys have with the Mac?
Well, I'll start with in 1987, I think, my dad started a company, and he needed a way to produce data sheets for the products that he was making, which are like product brochures. So he saw that you could buy a Mac SE and a laser printer and use Aldus PageMaker at the time to design your own publications, essentially, and then print them out in very high quality. And then you could just take that that hard copy from the laser printer to a printer, a proper printer, and they would, reproduce it. Or maybe they took the files. I guess they did that. But anyway, so we had a Mac SE, and we played, I think the only game we ever really bought for it was Shadowgate, and it was really neat, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And we also had some shareware games, and between 87, 88, and like the 90, 94 or so when I first bought my first vintage Mac while I was collecting, I only played that SE a few times every once in a while when I was at my dad's company. They've eventually relegated it to a back room, and I would go in there and play Dungeon of Doom and stuff. And it was fun.
Nice. And Ben?
So, yeah, we had a bunch of Macs when I was growing up. In the earlier era, I had a TI, which is a different episode we'll get to, and my dad had an Osborne, which is a really old clunky portable.
Man, I don't even know if we can fill a micro with an Osborne.
Yeah, no, I don't know about that. You can say a few sentences about the Osborne.
10 seconds.
So obviously those weren't cutting it going forward. We had a very early Mac Plus, and at some point we upgraded it to a Mac SE. And, I've had Mac. I mean, those were shared with the family, but I've had Macs ever since then. I ended up with a Centris and then on through Power Macs, and now we're into the 90s. So I played a bunch of stuff on the old Macs. I was into the shareware scene. I tried writing some a few times. I don't know if any of them ever really got distributed.
That's cool. I didn't know that.
I sent some into one of the catalogs that distributes sharewares for you. Mm-hmm. You pay a nominal fee for discs, and they'll send you discs.
What were they called? What the games you made?
The biggest one I finished was Quest for the Golden Orb. It was a HyperCard thing.
Uh-huh. That sounds cool.
Yeah, we should definitely talk about HyperCard.
Yeah,
later on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. HyperCard is the best thing. So I was super into HyperCard. I actually, in high school, I got a chemistry teacher to let me do an independent study writing software for his classes, mostly in HyperCard, because that was what I knew. That was a lot of fun. Early Macs were awesome. Just like a home for really great pixel art, because they were pretty much the thing for high-res pixels at that
they
point.
They were high-res.
Everything else, you had your DOS boxes, which were all text and ASCII based back then, and then you had things like your Commodores and Amigas, which had color graphics but was low res.
Yeah, 320 by 200 kind
of
thing. So the Mac,
I don't remember the exact resolution of Mac, but it was like 512 by 224 384.
It changed a few times.
512 by 384 is the classic Mac, I think.
Yeah, okay. I think that was the first one. And then it went up quickly because I ran into this problem where, I had written a stack at home on my, I think it was an SE. and I tried to bring it to school and run it on one of their older ones, and it was a bigger resolution. Yeah. You had to like pan and scan to see what I did. Because they upped their resolution fairly quickly.
640 by 480 by default.
Pretty quick.
On those modular machines.
It was pretty unusual to see such a high resolution at that time on computers. Like, the only other place you really saw it was on Japanese PCs, which needed the high resolution
for their characters.
Because, you know, they had complicated kanji characters. Kanji. So that was sort of a necessity. But yeah, Max, even though they were monochrome, literally one bit graphics.
Yeah.
Black or white, that's it.
So you got this niche of just like really gorgeous one-bit high-resolution graphics that existed there and nowhere else. And a lot of people really played to that strength, making things for it.
Yep. Have you seen the port of Gauntlet for the Mac, for example?
I have not seen
it's
that.
Like, maybe.
It's crazy because it's all black or white, but it's like just these ridiculously gorgeous little characters that are, you know, so much more detailed than the arcade.
Yeah, I didn't have that.
It's black and white.
It was just a combination you didn't see other places. Like, you tended to have some color options and lower resolution, but you didn't have a system with such high resolution but monochrome output. It wasn't a combination that existed anywhere else. And so between that and I think the Macintosh's emphasis on a visual interface, it just lent itself to a very unique, very beautifully crafted artistic games. And that legacy carried through on into the 90s, you know, even after the sort of visual abilities of game systems or computer systems sort of to level out. There was still this sort of unique high-res look to Macintosh games. Like, if you look at the sprites in Marathon and compare those to the sprites in Doom, they just look different.
Yeah.
Like, there is a different aesthetic, a different
mindset. 640 by 480 was the baseline in those days, the color Macs. So, I mean, that was... And VGA is 320 by 200, right?
Yeah, you just 256
had more to work with. Colors. So they were making those 320 by 200 up until the late 90s. You know, those games. Like, you
just to be compatible Doom with VGA.
So there you go.
Yeah, it's I like that you mentioned Aldus PageMaker, because before I owned a Macintosh when I went off to college, in like school, you know, elementary school, then junior high school or high school, we had Macs in the computer labs, and in high school, I used a Mac, like an SE, I think, probably, to put together our student newspaper, which we did in Aldus PageMaker, I would put together these very elaborate vector graphics in whatever the predecessor
Mac Draw
to. No, Microreal. It was
Proto Illustrator.
Actually, it was something kind of like Illustrator, but it was just for typography.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it was called. I think it was by Macromedia or whatever company.
I don't remember the title, but
Aldus, I guess.
Aldus.
But yeah, like I would make these like very elaborate headers for monthly columns in the newspaper, and they would take about an hour to print out on a laser printer because they had to go through all these complex calculations for the vector or the vector art.
Yeah, the postscript.
Yeah, I would do like desktop publishing stuff for assignments in high school on my Mac, and all the other students would be like, "Oh, come on, man, that's not fair. Those look too good." Like,
yeah, the Mac was so versatile. PageMaker was so versatile. Like, and there was one time when someone submitted a column and it was too long to fit. So I just bumped the size down one pixel. My teacher was like, "You never do that." He came to me with a printed magazine, was like, "You don't change the font size.
It has to be consistent.
Edit it down."
Yeah, yeah.
So it was a learning experience.
Yeah, but I think that emphasis, I mean, the early Mac had a huge emphasis on desktop publishing and design, because that was one of the niches that was what they were gunning for. Again, with the high resolution and the ability to do all this graphical manipulation and typesetting. And I think that actually fed into the early Mac game scene too, in that you had a lot of people attracted to this platform who were more from the design side of things, who had not necessarily been game developers, who didn't come from that edge, but who came at it from a design perspective. And so you see a lot of early Mac games that are maybe not very gamey, but are more, are almost, you know, there was a search of things that today would get called art games. That were more about design.
So you like walking concepts on the Macintosh.
Yeah. There's some things in our
you
list.
You could call
that
them like
kind of
graphical toys too. There were other things where like a cat would follow a mouse around or something.
It wasn't really a game. It was just a widget.
Yeah, a widget thing.
Yeah, the Neko.
Yeah, I think there's probably a game or two on here that probably qualify more as like digital toys than video games. But I still remember them and they were still fun and I enjoyed messing around with them. Thank you. I guess we should maybe start out by talking a little bit about the history of the Macintosh itself. I don't know how much you guys really want to get into that, but I think it is important to sort of understand where it came from. You know, Apple hit it big with the Apple II in the late 70s, and that was a massive breakout. It was a massive success. It really helped sort of commoditize computers. It helped turn computers into something people owned and people mm-hmm. used. And so, you know, immediately there were people nipping at Apple's heels, trying to come up with something better or something cheaper. You know, you had just a variety of personal computers. Things like the VIC-20 maybe didn't really stand up so well, but the C64, that gave the Apple II a good run for its money. So, yeah. Of course, Apple was yeah. determined to make the next big thing for themselves. And there were a few different ideas that they had that did not pan out so well.
And there's reasons you've never heard of them.
The first was the Apple III, which yeah. seems like the logical next step. What do you guys know about the Apple
III? Well, I'll point this out, which is Apple was always gunning for the upper end of the market, like mm-hmm. the home market and the low end of the business market. So they saw the IBM PC as an existential threat. And everyone knew IBM was making a PC, even when they, I think when they did the Apple III in 80, you know, mm-hmm. that PC came out in 81. They knew something was coming from IBM, and they knew they needed to make a business machine. So a camel is a horse designed by committee, as they say. So uh-huh. they threw a bunch of engineers onto a thing that had nothing to do with, and they made a monstrosity. It was a giant circuit board. Didn't do much. It had a sophisticated operating system, SOS. That's literally what it was called.
Yeah, that seems like a bad starting point.
Let's. Of course, it's called SOS, which is, yeah, it's not to save our ship. Like,
I'm not a good omen.
Mayday,
now.
Mayday.
Yeah. What did the first S stand for? I'm sure it's operating system.
Sophisticated.
It was actually sophisticated.
Sophisticated,
yeah. Sophisticated okay. operating system, yeah.
But yeah, maybe.
It became ProDOS later. That was the roots of ProDOS.
Interesting. I didn't realize that.
Hmm. Yeah.
So that bled II-E back area. Into the Apple II.
Yeah, it did.
Huh. Okay.
The funny thing is, they were like the Apple III cost. Man, like $5,000 or something ridiculous, which is, you know, inflation, $17,000 yeah, today or something. I'm just pulling that out of here, but, you know, not a calculator. But yeah, so they, but the funny thing is they found that most people were buying them and using them in the Apple II compatibility mode, which you could put in a disk and boot it into Apple II mm-hmm. mode. And so they became glorified Apple IIs with the built-in disk drive and whatever, you know, so built-in serial port. It had stuff built in, like unlike the Apple II at the time.
It's kind of like buying a $5,000 3DS and only using it to play DS games.
Yeah,
pretty much.
That'd be funny. $5,000 DS. The screen the size of this room.
Yeah, just a really nice OLED. Really,
yeah, glass, gold.
So yeah, the Apple III kind of missed the point. And it was yeah. a disaster.
It was a total disaster.
Yeah, I've never actually seen one because neither no one actually has one.
Steve Jobs. Sure very expensive. I have one, but I've seen two in my life. Like there's one at a school sitting around years later that they didn't know what to do with. And I was like, can I have that? And they're like, no, it belongs to the school system. That was when I was in high school. And they threw it away. You can't own it. It has to be owned by the trash.
Destroyed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The same thing happened with Elisa. I saw Elisa in my library when I was in middle school. I was like, oh my God, that's the most amazing thing I've ever seen because I was already collecting computers. And I got my mom to go to the library to ask them if I could buy it or have it or something. And same answer, obviously. You know, they can't sell it. It belongs to the school system. So there you go.
So this is the next try, Lisa.
All right. So yeah, we should talk about the Lisa also because that was, I think that's the one Steve Jobs wanted to be the next big thing. And the Lisa shares a lot of common heritage with the Macintosh. They were both inspired by all the ideas that Apple stole from Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, Xerox Park, mm-hmm. Graphical user interface and so on and so forth. But the Mac would be sort of like the graphical user interface system equivalent of the Apple II. Whereas the Lisa was more like the Apple III, very, very expensive, very over-designed, just kind of bloated.
Yeah, so I think the common story, if you want to summarize the Lisa development, was that Steve Jobs wanted to do it, and it got assigned to a bunch of engineers they hired away from Xerox and other places, and they threw tons of money at it, yeah, and it got over-engineered, and they sold it for $10,000. It had these horrible...
That's a 1980 money, folks.
Yeah, 1983 money is when it came out. So it had two Twiggy drives, they call it, because there were these weird, you know, dual density 5.25 inch. Or was it 5.25? 3.5, I don't
remember.
Twiggy, what, like the model?
Yeah. Twiggy, because they're thin discs, okay. I guess. I don't know.
Huh.
So you could flip them or something. No, you couldn't flip them. It just had two reed heads, you know, instead of one. It looked like a standard 5.25 disc. But anyway, so...
So it was just two heads for speed?
Yeah, for like whatever, better density storage. But they were horrible failures. They had high failure rates. And so they ended up having to replace it with the 3.5 inch Sony drive like they use in the Mac later. And that's why the Twiggy Macs the Twiggy Leases are so rare. Hmm. They're incredibly rare.
Because they're failure prone.
Yeah, most people return them if they bought them. I mean, you spend $10,000 on a machine, which is like $50,000 or something.
Several times more than your car, probably.
Yeah, like your house at the time. You're going to be like, yeah, I want it to be fixed. I want to use it, you know?
Right. Interesting. So, yeah.
But it was the first commercial GUI system under $25,000. There was a Xerox Star, which was like $25,000 or something like that.
That was definitely not meant for home users.
Yeah,
that was meant for business applications.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, that was like a business, big business thing. So,
Lisa was a breakthrough. Home user only if you're rich and an early adopter.
It pioneered metaphors of windowed computing and graphical desktop mouse-based stuff and drop-down menus and things like that. I've written several articles about it if you want to go look them up.
Where would we find those?
Oh, boy. Search for Benj Edwards and Macworld, because I wrote stuff for Macworld. I was looking at my watch. Like, how many years?
A long time ago.
It's on my watch. Yeah, it was like from 2007 to like 2013. So it was a long time.
Okay. So yeah, definitely check those out. But the Lisa did not succeed. It was a huge failure because of the price, because of the unreliability, and just because there wasn't a lot of support for it. Meanwhile, in another part of the Apple campus, a bunch of plucky young rebels led by Jeff Raskin started developing a sort of similar project, but one meant to be more consumer-friendly. That was the Mac.
So Steve Jobs got kicked off the Lisa team, I think, or something like that, and then he went and took over Jeff Raskin's project.
Yeah, I mean, the Macintosh project was in the works for a while.
Yeah.
And it was meant to be
an appliance thing.
Yeah, it wasn't meant to be the next step of Apple's computing lineup. It was... It was a project that they were sort of exploring, but not with sort of the end vision of what it eventually became. And I think they did start doing the graphical user interface development and that sort of thing before Steve Jobs came on. But then, Steve Jobs did not make a lot of friends.
It wasn't mouse based. I'll put it that way. Steve came in and said, let's just make a low-cost Lisa, you know. Let's use the techniques we used with me and Waz in the garage, just a little band of engineers working as hard as we possibly can outside. Right. It's like a Skunk Works project.
Which is kind of what they were doing already. It's just that now one of the co-founders of the company was heading up the Skunk Works.
Yeah.
And that didn't necessarily make the existing team that happy. But it did, it eventually came to fruition, although a lot of the original vision for the system was compromised because of Jobs's like weird obsessions with things like it has to be super quiet, so there can't be a fan and there can't be an internal diskette drive.
And startup time was one of his big things.
Yeah.
It did have
come
an internal
on real
drive.
Quick.
What's that?
It did have an internal
disk drive.
Yeah.
Diskette.
Diskette. Yeah, it does.
What does it?
The Mac. The first Mac does.
256K?
The 128K, the first. Yeah, it does. It has one single 3.5 inch floppy.
So does it not have an internal hard drive?
There's no hard drive.
Yeah, the first one did not have an internal.
It has a 400K floppy.
Okay, so to really get any use out of it, you need to buy an external hard drive or a diskette drive or something. And I knew there was something that was missing.
First, you had to flip disks, or you could buy an external disk drive, but they didn't offer a hard drive until a little while later, external hard drive in the Mac. Maybe it was the Mac Plus era.
I think that was when they started
HD20 or something.
Yeah, it originally was a peripheral, but then they started integrating it with...
The SE had the first integrated hard drive option.
Okay, I was hoping I would have time to sit down and read up on this before the history, but...
I know, that's why you brought me here.
That is why I brought you here. There's a great book called Revolution in the Valley that I highly recommend to anyone. I got it I don't know, like 6 or 7 years ago for Christmas. And it really tells sort of the origin story of the Macintosh before and after Steve Jobs came on and how the project evolved. Like I said, I was hoping I would have time to reread that, but I didn't.
Okay.
So, anyway, that's kind of the general gist of everything.
Yeah, so it was a closed box. You couldn't add to it from the inside.
Yeah.
That was very appliance-like nature.
Yeah, Jobs really wanted an appliance where you just... Easy to buy, easy to plug in, just turn it on and it goes.
Yeah, I mean, you see in the original Macintosh, a lot of the things that would continue to be sort of defining traits of systems and projects that Jobs worked on. A closed system, you know, very elegant, very quiet, very self-contained. The Macintosh was a very strange and unique system. The idea of a, you know, the original 128K Mac was an all-in-one unit. It was monitor and CPU and then with an external keyboard. And that wasn't totally unheard of at the time, but it was very tiny and the monitor was black and white, very high resolution, like a very high quality 9-inch monitor. It was monochrome, like I said, but because of the high resolution, it looked different than most monochrome systems. For one thing, it wasn't reversed monochrome. Usually with monochrome systems, you had a black screen with like green or amber on it, you know, for the type. Whereas this, you know, it was the basic background was always a lighter color.
They wanted to simulate paper.
Yeah,
it was the push to get it to take over desktop publishing, basically. So you make it look like printing.
Yeah, that was a legacy of Xerox where they did, you know, desktop publishing stuff on the Alto with the white background stuff.
And that's both. Yeah, you need the white background, you need the high resolution. So you can put something on the screen that really looks like what you're going to print out, which was something that nothing else could do at that point.
Yeah, and we take that for granted now. That's the metaphor that all computers use. But before the Macintosh, you just didn't see that. It was very strange. Like, it made the Macintosh stand out, not just because of the very cute little box that made the little startup chime and gave you the little icons and stuff, but also just... the way you looked at it, and of course the way you interacted with it. It was a mouse-driven
accessible
computer.
Populist computer. It's the first computer that anyone could just pick up and use without knowing anything about it,
because you could and do things that were more than just
a mouse click, you know.
Do things that were more than just text. That's why the you know, the early ad had the hello drawn in script on the screen.
Yes, entirely bitmapped. You know, the display is something different instead of character based.
Yeah, that's also something important. Umberto Eco wrote an essay once a long time ago about how DOS, the PC, was Protestant and the Macintosh was Catholic, because it's built around icons and everything is sort of sealed away from you. You're not supposed to go probing into the system of the Macintosh. You're supposed to just accept what's given to you, and you kind of go through the processes that are presented to you by Apple. It's a really clever essay.
Yeah, that is clever.
But it does get down to the difference in how this system worked versus how computers worked at the time.
Well, there are exceptions too. There's some push and pull on this, because, you know, you also had people like Woz in here and people like the Hypercar guy.
I can't remember his name.
Suddenly just left my brain.
He's one of the
Who were very into to kind of hacking things and letting people build their own stuff, and you had them putting stuff on here too.
That wasn't the underlying philosophy.
It's not the hardware
system.
Yeah, it's not the hardware.
When you look at the Mac, you don't have, you know, like these crazy directories and hierarchies.
Right.
You have the system folder, and it's inside the system folder, there's things you can't throw away, no matter what you want to do. You can't delete your system. You can try. My grandfather, God bless his soul, every time I came to his house, he was like, my system is being weird. And I'd look, and the entire system folder was in the trash. But you had the trash. That was a metaphor.
Yeah.
You wanted to delete something, you didn't type in a command prompt. You clicked on it, and you drag it to a trash can.
It was very into making everything into a metaphor that was supposed to be universal.
Yeah, system extensions had little icons that looked like jigsaw puzzle pieces that said, like, oh, these are all pieces that fit
together.
Your
fonts came in suitcases.
Yeah. You know, there was the dog cow. I don't know what that was about, but it was there.
Right.
Dog cow.
It was just a different kind of computer system. And, you know, the Mac has evolved a lot over time, and now it's Unix-based, and it doesn't have the cute metaphors and everything that it used to. It's slicker, it's less personable, and it's actually pretty indistinguishable from Windows at this point. But, you know, back in the day, there was no Windows. It was not something that, you know, Microsoft hadn't entered that market yet.
Yeah, I mean,
they were working on it, but it's not like anyone wanted to use Windows 1 anyway. Windows didn't get usable until 3.
Yeah, eventually everyone decided those were good metaphors, and so everyone used them.
Right.
So, yeah.
So naturally, I think, you know, because of this and because of the mouse-driven interface, the point-and-click concept, the Macintosh naturally inspired a different kind of video game than other computers. And that's what we're going to talk about this episode.
Most Mac games don't have really any music for some reason. I can't think of anything, the ones I played. I mean, the early ones, I'm talking not like... It had a pretty good sound capability, though.
Yeah, a lot of old Mac games have, like, samples.
Yeah, like, yeah. In Shadowgate, like, there's...
Dark Castle has, like... Like, you can tell it's someone going, like... making sound effects for birds and stuff. But, I mean, there it is. It's right there. It's not like just... It's not just the mono speaker going burr, burr.
Yeah.
It's actually people like making voices. It's samples. It's distinct.
Yeah, and some of the ones we have in the list had really great samples.
But I mean, back then computer games didn't have
Macs
music
were the
either.
First to have stereo outputs too, I think, other than maybe some kind of like workstation or something. And high quality CD quality sound but that's for the 90s episode. We're gonna focus on the 80s.
So why don't we just jump into talking about Mac games from the beginning? And I guess the beginning would be Alice, the 1984 video game. The Mac, of course,
that's
launched in 1984.
That's the earliest one I know of.
It was why 1984 wasn't like 1984, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was nothing like 1984.
It wasn't. No, that's 2017. So Alice was actually... Have you guys played Alice?
I've never played it.
I did not have Alice. I've looked up playthroughs.
I've just seen the video.
I feel like I played it once a long time ago.
Andy Hertzfeld has a story about it. That's how I know about it on his folklore.org.
Actually, really impressive for being one of the first things that came out.
It wasn't originally a Mac game. It was a Lisa game. So it was developed for Lisa. And then when that exploded or imploded, it ended up that game was taken over to Mac because the two systems were very similar.
Right.
So actually, there's a fair amount of content that showed up in 1984. On Macintosh it actually got its start in life on Lisa. It's kind of like a Switch and Wii U, if you want to think of it that way.
Yeah, here's a bit of trivia. The Lisa had rectangular pixels, which was really weird.
That's right. I remember that.
They're wide, I think.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, wide.
Huh.
Yeah, they were not.
I did an article about like five of the main differences between the Lisa and the Mac or something that was really neat. Talks about some of the stuff the Lisa did that the Mac didn't do. Like you could just push a button and it would all shut down automatically and restore itself back up when you pushed it back on.
Which is what they do now, but it took them a long time to get that.
It took a long time for that, to like Lion or something.
Which is why it cost $50,000.
Right.
Yeah.
But
I digress.
So Alice was designed by a guy named Steve Capps, who is part of the sort of the legendary early Apple team. And it was basically... How did I describe it in the notes?
It's over-the-shoulder action chess, basically.
Yeah, it's like chess meets Space Invaders or Galaxy.
So you got...
Third-person action chess.
So you play as Alice, but you get to pick...
That's
like
Alice as in Alice in Wonderland.
Alice in Wonderland, right.
Yeah, I think it's actually called Alice Through the Looking Glass.
Right, because in Through the Looking Glass in the book, there was the whole chessboard thing going on.
Chess.
But so you can pick your difficulty, which is what chess moves Alice moves by. Right?
Yeah.
So being a queen is easier than being a pawn.
Yeah, you start
card.
The game by clicking on... an enemy piece. You control in the foreground just Alice, whereas the computer controls the entire other side of chess.
Yeah, the other side has a full chess.
And each of those move according to their rules. And you start the game by basically clicking on something. If you want to play like Limitless, you play as the queen who can move, you know, in horizontal, vertical, or diagonal directions.
As far as you want at a time.
Yeah. Whereas if you choose a pawn, you can move like two spaces and then one space from there on.
This sounds a lot like the rules of chess you're describing.
Yeah, so the pieces move by the rules of chess, but then you start doing this in real time, which is where it gets crazy. So you're just clicking to move Alice according to whatever rules she has, and meanwhile, enemy chess pieces are just periodically moving towards you.
Oh, yeah, like nonstop.
Yeah,
that's
like
what I
nonstop.
Saw in the video.
And you're trying to take them before they take you, basically.
Right.
As
if anyone,
in real time.
If anyone has a disc image of that, I want it. Because no one, I don't think it's out there.
I never owned that one, so I don't
it's
have
so
it.
It's so extremely rare.
Yeah.
Like, I've never played it or have it.
Yeah, I don't have the actual code
for it. Yeah, the video that I found on YouTube of the game, it's not like direct feed. So it's someone like filming a screen.
Camcordering, yeah.
And the title screen doesn't work because of some sort of hardware incompatibility. Maybe it's because of the Lisa Square Pixel thing. I don't know.
I think I saw one with the title screen that worked.
Okay. But yeah, like this game was made around the same time as Battle Chess, I want to say, and Archon.
Nah.
No?
That Little can't League be 4? Possible.
When was Battle Chess? Someone look it up while I model it.
Battle Chess.
But Battle Chess is...
On the C64? Did it originate on the C64? I thought
it
was VGA originally.
This is not a Battle Chess episode, so I didn't research it. But basically, these kind of came into being somewhere around the same time. And Battle Chess is, you know, more like the traditional chess game. Whereas this, you know, takes advantage of the fact that you had a mouse-based control, so there was a lot of precision and a lot of speed possible.
Clicking.
And clicking. And it makes... Like, it changes the game. It turns it from a turn-based game into a real-time game. And apparently, like, you can crank up the difficulty level as high as you want so the enemy gets more moves. Mm-hmm. And at some point, you get to a point where it's just moving so quickly you can't possibly keep up. And in addition to, you know, the enemy pieces are trying to move onto the same piece or same square that you occupy. But in addition to that, the enemy is also, the computer is sending as many pawns as possible up to queen them.
Yeah, so you can end up with multiple queens running around you, which is ridiculous. Yeah.
So it's like I said, I mean, there is this kind of element of like Galaxian or some other shooter to it where, you know, enemies are constantly moving and they're trying to promote themselves and trying to outmatch you.
It's very hyperactive, very quick. Yeah. I did look up original Battle Chess was 88.
Oh,
yeah, the very first
way
one.
Different. That sounds good.
Yeah.
Okay.
But
it kept coming out
on the Lisa versus 88 on the Battle Chess.
It kept coming out in newer versions up through like the 90s. But yeah.
Huh. Okay. Well, I stand corrected then.
Yeah. You're going to bring up Battle Chess every episode, aren't you?
Am I? Did we talk about that?
You compared Archon to Battle Chess.
We were like,
time.
Oh, yeah, Batman and Battle
Batman's
Chess.
Just like
Bat. They both start with Bat.
Battle Man. Chess. Yeah.
But anyway, about Alice Through the Looking Glass, like it's pretty simplistic now, but I can imagine in 1983, 84 looking at that and being like, wow.
Yeah, it's very impressive looking.
This is an amazing game. It's monochrome, but it's all beautifully drawn. It has this very exaggerated 3D
It's in perspective.
Yeah.
Like I said, over
it's
the
like
shoulder.
A vanishing one-point perspective, very skewed, but you know the pieces grow in size as they move towards you. Really just a great piece of artistry. It really shows off, I think, the capabilities of the hardware. And I feel like you didn't really see super fast action games that often on Mac. So it's not even like it was a taste of what was to come. It was just this kind of
really
like
unusual,
crazy
one-off.
Thing that was,
taste because it crazy.
Came, because it came from Lisa, it was kind of its own thing there.
So the next game I want to talk about is, well, actually, it's a tetralogy of games. That's right, tetralogy. It's
quadrilogy.
No, you're out of here. Get out. You're banned from Retro.
Just punched me.
So in 1985, a company called ICOM Simulations started developing a series of graphical adventure games, which has been kind of loosely termed the MacVenture series. And these are probably the best known,
some of the coolest games ever made
of all of these early Mac games, just among the general like console gaming population,
because they ended up on Nintendo.
Because three of the four ended up on NES, and the fourth one was made for NES but never published, and then showed up on GBA or Game Boy Color.
Okay,
and there was a Deja Vu 1 and 2. So anyway, these were ported to the NES by Kemco Seika, but I think, you know, it's worth talking about the original Mac games because they were, in a lot of respects, different than the games that ended up on Macintosh. You had Shadowgate, Uninvited, Deja Vu, and Deja Vu 2, Lost in Las Vegas, or Lost in New York, or whatever it's called. I don't know, Kevin McAllister killed someone, or was in...
just Lost in New York.
So, did Uninvited predate Shadowgate? Because I remember Shadowgate coming out first.
I
thought that was the first one.
I wasn't, like, trying to put these in chronological order. I just wrote them down as they came to my head.
We had Shadowgate, as I mentioned earlier, and it was just incredible because it used the drag and drop windowed metaphor to its fullest. I mean, you pick up items from the scene by clicking on them with your mouse and dragging them into a window that's your inventory right beside it. And it's like you were actually picking up objects and moving them and stuff.
Yeah, like fundamentally these resembled, you know, like a Sierra adventure or something. You had sort of the graphical window and you had the text parser.
It's first person. No.
What's that?
It's first person.
It is, but I mean, like, but fundamentally, like, you had the concept of combining maybe like as one of the graphical Zork games.
But it's an adventure where you're moving through different scenes that you have a big window of, but you also have like inventories and
right.
verbs.
It mixes
sort of
two sort of interfaces, but it's a much more seamless interface combination in ICOM's games.
Yeah, so it adopts the new Max metaphors and basically brings them into this genre and runs with them. So you have picking up things with the mouse and putting them places and all that sort of stuff that...
It's also it's brutal too. Like you can fall down a pit and die easily. There's something in the beginning where you push a candlestick the wrong way and you fall in a pit.
Yeah, Shadowgate is full of just like
instant
surprise.
Surprise, you're dead. Yeah.
But the thing is the text is written so vividly and with kind of a tongue in cheek attitude. And there's always, you know, some sort of interesting animation that goes along with it, and then the Grim Reaper shows up. Like, you don't... I don't know. When I played Shadowgate on Mac or on NES, I never felt like, oh, this game is so cheap and unfair because, like, you die, but it's not that punishing.
They make the deaths into part of the game.
Yeah, you go back a screen or two, and it's no big deal. Then you're like, oh, I have to do this differently. It's not like a Sierra game where you screw up and you're like, oh, guess I got to start the game all over again.
Yeah.
It never did that.
Yeah, they made the deaths into being part of the game. Like you kind of want to see the deaths because they're funny. And so it's not so much a setback. It's like, oh, I saw this funny part of the game. It happens that I'm dead. I have to go again, but whatever.
I didn't think they were funny. I thought they were terrifying.
Well, okay.
Of course, I was like 6
Depends
years
on the game,
old.
Well, you're just a very delicate child.
Yeah.
Some of them were funny. Some of them were terrifying. But
serious when you're 6.
But they're interesting is the point. The death isn't just a punishment. It's like you get to see something interesting.
Yeah, like it's the same philosophy behind Time Gal, where like every death is comical. Or Dragon's Lair, if you want.
Yeah,
if you want.
Right.
Actually, Dragon's Lair is probably the better suggestion here because it came before the Mac Venture games. But you did sort of see this interface style on PC games in Japan. You know, Yuji Horii's Portopia serial murder case that also used... like the first person adventure style with text parser and like an inventory window. But again, it didn't have the mouse element because it was made for, I don't know, PC 88 or something.
Yeah.
So this was kind of like pushing that in the next step, you know, to the next level. And, you know, the quality of the writing, it was very vivid, almost lurid in places. It wasn't afraid to kind of poke fun at the player. It had that sort of tongue-in-cheek style that Zork did, but then it added the visual element. And I would say that ICOM did visuals, like integrating visuals into the adventure better than Zork ever did. I don't think Infocom ever really mastered that. They were great at text. Like no one did text like Infocom.
That's fair.
But ICOM really managed to come up with good text, maybe not Infocom quality, but good, and also combined it with really vividly, beautifully drawn black and white scenery. So, you know, the first game, Shadowgate, was a journey into a haunted castle ruled by a mad wizard. The second was Uninvited, where you went, or maybe Deja Vu was the second one.
Haunted house.
But there was Uninvited. A haunted house, yeah, haunted mansion, and then... Deja Vu was kind of a noir, you know, 1930s detective murder mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And all of them were great. A lot of just, yeah, like the only one I've ever finished is Shadowgate, but I've definitely played all of them. And there are some differences between the NES and Mac versions, necessarily because of NES censorship. A lot of the stuff in the Mac version was, or the NES version was toned down to be less violent or less bloody or less sexual.
I felt like Shadowgate was really scary. I mean, there's dragon and coffins and the Grim Reaper and it was, you know, it has a gothic, really scary kind of theme to it.
Yeah, I didn't actually play this one when it came out. So yeah, that would have been, you know, I would have been only 10 when it came out, but I didn't actually play it then. So I never got the like little kid being terrified by this stuff. But I can totally see that happening, yeah, having seen it later.
Well, on the Mac, I think I played through the NES version all the way, and they may have toned it down so much that it feels more playful and stuff, mm-hmm, you know. But there are great versions on the Apple II GS that are in full color. Oh, you, yeah, think of Uninvited and Deja Vu.
That's right. Yeah,
operate just like the Mac drag and drop. They're really good.
Yeah, and I really think the big innovation here was taking the Macintosh Park, you know, Xerox Park desktop GUI drag and drop metaphor and extending it to the video game itself. Mm-hmm. That was just like a very obvious bridge to make, but no one had done it before them that I know of.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, this genre already existed, but it really lends probably itself to the strengths of the system.
Yeah, one of the... So. Yeah, a key development in a GUI-based game, you know.
Yeah, because you've got the system now that's, you know, it's got this high resolution we keep talking about, so that plays to the strength of you have this big graphical window showing you where you are that you want to look as good as possible, and then now you've got this GUI interface with a mouse that just lends itself to, you know, shuffling your items and all the sorts of things that you already were doing.
High resolution ice clinking,
yes.
I can feel it with the HD rumble.
Yes, the HD rumble.
I think you have 3 ice cubes in there.
There's four if you're wrong. You owe me a drink.
Fail at 1-2 switch. I already gave you a drink.
But so yeah, all the metaphors of this new platform lent themselves really well to this genre, and so this just, you know, took it and plugged it in, and it works really well.
So the next game worth talking about is one by Chris Crawford, who is still kind of a known name in
Chris
video
Cross.
Games. Not Chris Cross. That was on Sega CD. This was Chris Crawford. It was called Balance of Power. Not to be mistaken for Balance of Terror, the classic Star Trek episode.
Jeez.
That's right, I can out-nerd you.
Chris Crawford will make
it. We're not even trying.
All right, so Balance of Power is one of those games that's way outside my wheelhouse. It is a strategy simulation game, but it's extremely well regarded. It's considered one of the classics of the genre. In fact, I just recently saw a thread on NeoGAF that was talking about micro genres of games, like not full fledged, you know, genres that there are hundreds of entries in, but just kind of like there's like 5 or 6 games like this, and they're all kind of based around one game. Balance of Power is one of the games that created a micro genre. You had a map of the US and the Soviet Union, well, basically the world, and you played as either the US president or the Soviet premier, and your goal was to build your country's prestige higher than that of the rival nation without sparking a nuclear war.
Yeah, so it's worldwide geopolitics.
Basically.
Cold War edition. And yeah, there's some things that followed in that same vein, but it's a pretty niche thing there.
Yeah, I mean, it's much more limited in scope than something like Sid Meier's Civilization. It's not meant... Right. It's not about, like, you know, follow your civilization through multiple millennia and create the ultimate, you know, the ultimate state
it's
of humanity.
Sort of like it's political about risk. Like risk with politics.
Yeah, it takes place over 8 years, and each year is sort of like an extended term where you can act and react and make choices. But you have to be really careful about your choices, because if you provoke the other side into going on the offensive, then the game ends. The idea being that, you know, if everything goes nuclear, no one's going to come out of it alive, so you've lost the game.
It's a global conflict game, but it's not. It's an anti-war game instead of being a war game. It's a diplomacy game where war is the losing condition.
The only way to win is not to play.
Exactly.
If only we could avoid playing. So so that was that game saw a lot of conversions to other platforms and was widely imitated, but it got a start on Mac. Yeah, then the Mac got its own roguelike kind of game.
This is
in
my
the form
favorite
of the
Mac
Dungeon
game.
Of Doom, aka the Dungeon Revealed, and I looked at this and said, "Oh yeah, that seems interesting," but I haven't played it. So, as someone who loves the game, tell us why it's great.
Well, that was the first roguelike I ever played. I mean, this is, you know, I played in 1987 on the SE, and it was distributed as shareware as under the name Dungeon of Doom. And It's like a Rogue or a NetHack with a mouse. So it's a GUI, like probably the first GUI-based, mouse-based roguelike where you have a grid and you have these richly illustrated little people. And
that's also different from the usual roguelike at the time, as opposed to being just ASCII characters.
Yeah, ASCII characters.
Sprites, like characters.
That was an innovation.
Symbolic images.
And you have a you click around your guy on the grid to move, and you click on an enemy to attack it, and it goes boom, boom, like a nice sampled sound. And you pick up, double-click on weapons to pick them up, and there's a little drop-down menu. You can wield the weapons you've got or whatever, and cast scrolls or drink spells.
Oh yeah, one of the things I really liked about this game, just kind of watching some demos on YouTube, is that it doesn't try to build all of its menus into the game interface. It also uses the system interface at the top.
Thing.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
The Mac system menu. Like, you want to go to equip armor, then you go to the equipment menu at the top of the screen,
which was super common on old Mac games. I mean, the paradigm at the time before everything was windowed was you have the top menu bar is always there. Mm-hmm. And so you're meant to use it. And so a lot of old Mac games, you would just create their own entire ecosystem of menus in the top menu bar.
Yeah, I didn't play enough of these old games to really have noticed that. That's
A lot of them do that, especially in more complicated things, like obviously like a roguelike or a role-playing game. But you could even do that like from within HyperCard. Some of my HyperCard games, I took over the menu bar and made it do my own stuff.
So when did HyperCard come into being? Was that was like 87 or 88, wasn't it?
Yeah, 87 sounds about right to me.
I should have looked out the history.
Yeah, before we take our mid-episode break,
no
why don't you
know.
Tell us, what is HyperCard?
Tell us
why it's amazing.
Okay, so I could easily do a whole mini-episode on HyperCard if Jeremy wants to indulge me sometime. But briefly, so HyperCard was sort of a development system that was made within the early Mac system. And it was, I got the guy's name now, it was Bill Atkinson was the guy. It was the
Bill Atkinson.
Yeah, Bill Atkinson. So it was originally devised as basically a way to let you organize your own information, and customize it to do what you need to do. So the reason it's called HyperCard is the paradigm is you have a stack of cards like a file system, or like a Rolodex. Yeah. Index cards like a Rolodex. So the idea is you could use this to make a Rolodex, of addresses, or you could use it to make an index of recipes or whatever you have. And so that's what it's really originally set up for. So you can have, I mean, it came with several sample ones that were just set up to do this out of the box, but then you can make your own. So it has, you can position text fields, you can position
buttons. Multimedia too.
Yeah, you can put in images.
Sounds.
You can put in sounds. Mm-hmm. And then you can define something that's the same for an entire stack. So you have a background that's constant, but then you can have different things on each card.
And don't forget the hypertext part of it.
And there's a scripting language.
That's where it really gets great.
Which is key, yeah. So there's a scripting language, and you can add a script to anything. So like a field can have its own, a button has its script to do things, a field can have its own script, the entire stack can have handlers, and it's a very robust entire programming language.
And you can click from any one, highlight word to go to another one, like the web.
Yeah, you can make it.
That's the hypertext part.
You can do hypertext in it. So you can very easily make your own Rolodex things that are like searchable and they have special conditions or whatever. But then if you dig into it, you can do almost anything with it because you can like have a button and put an icon on it and then tell it to move around the screen. And, oh, look, now you've got a sprite. I actually wrote a prototype of a platformer in HyperCard, which is ridiculous. It's so not designed for that.
Yeah, that sounds very unintuitive.
It's completely insane. But but you can do it. The point is you can do almost anything. But so it also lends itself very well to adventure games, right? Because you can have different images on different screens, regions of the screen where you click on them and things happen. And you can just, there's this built-in, very easy scripting language that you can script it to your heart's content to do what you want. And so that leads into like the Cheyenne stuff, like the Manhole and eventually Myst, which were all built on HyperCard.
Yep. Yeah, the best-selling adventure game of all time was built on a jazzed-up HyperCard.
Yeah,
stack.
So Myst, all this full-color gorgeousness. It's just a HyperCard stack underneath, and then it just has people wrote extensions to just let you overlay full-color stuff onto it once Color Max started being adopted.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about what you do in Myst, all you do is click on regions of the screen, and stuff happens.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, you pick something up. Mostly, you just go places or you hit buttons, and it makes stuff happen. And so it's just a bunch of connected cards with this gorgeous full color graphics and occasional motion videos and stuff laid over them. So you could do all kinds of things in this. I also, one of the things I wrote for my chemistry teacher was this whole like adventure game with like Zelda-like controls where you walk around on a grid and run into things and pick up inventory. Cool. Yeah. Chemistry. HyperCard is awesome.
Yeah, I tried doing a school project on HyperCard in 1997, and my teacher was like, HyperCard, wow, I didn't think anyone still used that. I was like, oh, I'm just getting started. I don't program, so
yeah,
that's what I had.
We did a little HyperCard tutorial when I was in middle school. They had a Mac lab there or something, and they just showed us how to put some buttons on the screen and click on it. It's like, oh, educated now.
Yeah, I don't know that any of the games that we'll talk about in the second half of this episode were built on HyperCard.
Yeah, but, well, I mean, Manhole is actually in the 80s, but if we want to leave that to Cyan's
stuff for next time.
Yeah, because most of their stuff is 90s.
The 90s Mac stuff has a very different character than the 80s. So.
Yeah, there weren't a lot of big things that came out in HyperCard game-wise, because mostly it was utilities. Until Cheyenne started doing Manhole and leading into Myst and all that, there were shareware things that would pop up, but nothing that really hit it big until the Manhole, I think.
Yeah, I know I name dropped the site every single time we talk about computers and then some, but I strongly recommend people check out the Digital Antiquarians piece on HyperCard programs and kind of like the philosophy behind the adventure games that built up around that, and even things like nonlinear poetry that people were sort of exploring with these multimedia concepts. It's filfre.net, filfre.net.
Put it in the show notes.
Yeah, in the show notes. But yeah, it there's some really great writing there. Like, it's just a great resource, and a lot of research and exposition went into this. So if you really want to know more about HyperCard, that's a great place to look. Anyway, let's take a break now, and while we empty our bladders or whatever, you guys can enjoy some advertisements.
I'm going to fill my bladder. I don't know about you.
And caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of...
chocolates.
Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolates.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile's super reliable, super fast nationwide network and get 4 lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get 4 free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
You know, when you're a kid, there are a lot of things that you think exist. Unicorns, dragons, mermaids, you name it. When you're a kid, it's real. But when you find out later that they don't, well, it's kind of disappointing. Of course, as you get older, you get over the disappointment. But when you're looking to buy a car, there's nothing worse than finding the one of your dreams online, and then you find out later, it doesn't really exist. It's not true. That's why at TrueCar, they show you real pricing on actual inventory. This isn't pricing offered to you by TrueCar. It's an actual VIN-based price from a TrueCar-certified dealer in your area. Real prices. And these aren't just any dealers either. TrueCar-certified dealers are a carefully curated network of dealers committed to transparency. They offer competitive prices and a faster, easier buying experience for you. It's a fact. TrueCar customers are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with the TrueCar certified dealers. And, on average, they save over $3,000 off the MSRP. So when you're ready to buy that dream car, visit TrueCar and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
Folks, I have read a lot of books, something I'm reminded of when I pay my student loan bills every month. And speaking from experience, I know how hard it is to drive the many distractions out of your life to stare at pressed wood pulp for hours on end. Thankfully, we have Audible, the audiobook service with over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. And for all of you listeners of Retronauts, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. To take advantage of this offer, just head over to www.audibletrial.com/game. That's www.audibletrial.com/game and start your free trial today. And if you're looking for a recommendation to get started, I completely recommend Jim Henson, The Biography by Brian J. Jones. It's an absolutely exhaustive exploration of the famous puppeteer's life, from his early years on local television to his futile attempts to break away from the Muppets throughout the 80s. And did you know that lovable bearded Jim Henson had a dark side? Well, you can listen to nearly 22 hours of Henson facts by heading to www.audibletrial.com/game and starting your free trial.
This is Norman Lear with my great sidekick, Paul Hipp.
Good to be here with you, Norman, on All of the Above.
That's the name of my podcast, All of the Above. And it's called All of the Above because we're going to talk about all of the above. There isn't anything sacrosanct.
There's nothing too above us or below us.
Or below us. Well, certainly nothing too below us. But we have had guests you cannot believe.
Yeah.
Guests.
Julie Louis-Dreyfus, amazing.
Yes. And America Ferrera.
Jared Carmichael.
Yes. Oh, Amy Poehler. How did we overlook? We didn't overlook Amy Poehler. I was saving her for last. And Charles Barkley, I was saving him for first, actually, because I didn't declare up first.
I get to hang out with this guy. And this is your chance to hang out with Norman Lear a little bit here and some of these great guests.
God, I wish I was you hanging out with Norman Lear.
Yeah.
Son of a gun. See? That must be exciting.
It's the best. I'm telling you.
Don't miss All of the Above with Norman Lear. Download new episodes every week on the Podcast One app or subscribe at podcastone.com.
And we're back. I hope you enjoyed the break and bought lots of cool stuff to support us, because that's what we're desperately begging you for. Before we get going with the second half of this discussion, I put out a call yesterday for listener mail about Mac games and got a bunch of responses. So I'm going to kind of go through the mailbag really quickly and just read a few, few responses.
You have to pause for the mail theme song.
We don't have a mail theme song.
Mail. I'll make you one.
It's males and females. It's okay. All genders are allowed to send us
epistles.
Letters. What's that?
They sent us epistles.
Pistols and stamens. Stamens.
We're going to read them to you now.
Yes. Okay. So from Ryan Nims, because I was pretty young in the early to mid 80s, my only memorable experience from the time was Oregon Trail, which of course has already been covered on Retronauts. I mean, that was more of an Apple II game, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it was big. I got the Mac port. But
on the Mac.
It was a teletype game, damn it.
The thing is, you know, Macs were in so many school labs after the Apple. After the Apple II, because Apple kept up its educational footprint. Yep. So
everyone had Oregon Trail because it's educational.
Yep.
Yeah.
However, about 5 years ago, I did manage to play a bit of Castle Wolfenstein by emulation. That's not what, I didn't put that on the list. Of course, the visuals and sound are extremely crude by today's standards, but Silas Warner's The Voice program was so far ahead of its time, and those robotic German voices still sound great. The stealth is uncompromising, and thus the game is not easy, but it's great to see the origin of one of my favorite game franchises of all time.
But that didn't originate on the Mac.
Yeah, I think of that more as an Apple II
game.
It was
a port, but I have the discs for it in the box there.
Oh, wow. Let's stick them in and see what happens. Do you have a slot on that MacBook Air there?
Put the slot. Floppy in my Mac Air.
If you fold it, it'll fit in.
Yeah.
Totally.
You can get a Twiggy disc in there.
Twiggy, yeah.
From Curtis Zinger, I work in a law firm that recently gave away a Mac Classic from the early 90s after using it in a patent prosecution case. I'm the lucky guy who received it. It's in stellar condition, and after bringing it home, the monochrome image is as sharp and beautiful as I imagined it would be. Problem is, only Tetris exists on its hard drive. It's the great game, but it's the only one I have. Therein lie my questions for you and your guests. Can I play any of the games you mentioned will mention on this episode on this Mac Classic? And two, where is the best place to pick up some floppy disk versions of these classic games?
Yes.
I mean, they should play, but
so
how do you get
all of them?
So, yeah, you can play.
Yeah, you should be able to play
Mac,
all this
A Mac
stuff.
Classic should be able to play anything, everything. Like System 7 and before.
Everything we're mentioning in this episode.
Yeah, anything black and white can play on the Mac Classic.
Yeah, black and white. As long as it's black and white, it should be fine.
Yeah, you can get them either by piracy. I mean, you can download disk images and burn and use disk copy if you can get that on your get a copy of it through eBay or a friend or something, and then you can.
We're allowed to say that on here.
Yeah. when it comes to PC games, the medium is so fragile.
Right.
Like, I really don't have a problem saying like just find a copy of it on the internet. If you want to track down on eBay and get the original diskettes and cross your fingers and hope to God that they still work, more power to you.
And then when they don't work, download it from the internet.
At this point, we're at a lot of people who make these old games.
These
are like crumbly papyrus. Think of it like crumbly papyrus. Like, are you going to make somebody go buy a copy of, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls to read them?
And several of these actually are
the original.
Are in fact GPL now. I came across that when looking up some of these games, that they've actually been released into the public domain now. So you can actually perfectly legally download them from the internet and stick them on your
You can also buy them on eBay.
There's a site called the Something Garden. I can't remember.
Oh, Mac Garden.
The Mac Garden, is that it? Yeah.
They have a lot of stuff to collect old links.
So, I mean, I guess ask yourself, like, what do I believe is right and just? And find your games that way.
Or just do it. Also,
I mean,
there's a Mac floppy emulator device that I have. It's called Floppy EMU that you can use like a floppy drive. It plugs into the floppy port. I think it's a 15-pin port or something, or 18-pin on the back of every classic Mac. And it acts like a floppy drive. And so you put something on an SD card, the disk images, and you can boot them from there. So that's probably the best
thing. Something like that for the Famicom disk system. It's a great idea.
Nice.
All right. So here's one from Crary Myers. He actually wrote a lot. I'm just going to jump to the Dungeon of Doom part because we just talked about that. Dungeon of Doom had a lasting effect on me, in as much as I am still an avid roguelike player. It had an even greater effect on me than Rogue, which I played first. For those who don't know, the game is a fairly simple graphical dungeon roguelike. Explore random dungeons, find items, identify them, kill monsters, repeat. But it had actual graphics in all their monochrome glory, unlike Rogue's ASCII interface. I played and enjoyed Rogue, but for some reason the graphics made all the difference. And one other thing, there were wish scrolls. This blew my young mind. In practice, they were most useful for getting you some item, like a weapon or potion. But because you got to type in what you wanted, I was sure that someday I'd find something super cool I hadn't thought of. I'm not quite sure what I wanted, a laser gun, a peppy holder, but it seemed like maybe I could get it.
Nice.
That was cool. I remember the wish scrolls now that you mention it.
Yeah, that's cool. It had those.
Dungeon of Doom is awesome.
And that was actually something I was going to say when we were talking about it before. I don't know the answer to this, but I was kind of wondering if any Japanese people were into Dungeons of Doom who later led to the mystery dungeon genre. Because now we have all these things coming out of Japan that are basically easier roguelikes, but they're very graphically presented.
I'm trying to set up some interviews at Spike Chunsoft.
You should ask them.
I've interviewed
just because looking at Dungeon of Doom wasn't one I played, but looking at the videos of it, you know, it has that look to it. It's on this checkerboard grid. It kind of, like, you know, almost looks like a game board. And I feel like I've seen mystery dungeons that have that look.
I mean, you know, Dragon Quest and a lot of those games were inspired by wizardry. So.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there were lots of people
there
playing.
Well, was the Mac big in Japan? That's the question, and that's an answer I do not know. I mean, it's very popular among collectors in Japan because I looked at
a lot of
collector
sites. I feel like there was a period in the middle where there were a lot of Macs where
it existed. I mean,
they like to soup up color classics to make them crazier.
It was a different kind of computer than you could otherwise buy in Japan.
Yeah, I don't think the really early Macs, took over from the
black and white era.
The PCs, the PCs that were really big in Japan, the 98 and whatever. I don't think it really ate their market. DOS, I think later on, when people were doing graphical stuff and desktop publishing and stuff, Mac got a lot of inroads then. But I don't know.
But you know, its high resolution thing would have made it good for their Japanese character sets, probably. Right, the screen.
I think so.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
So a letter from Reagan Kelly. I'm not entirely sure how Mac games got into our house in that pre-internet era, but there were always one or two games on discs scattered around my dad's home office.
They're called game
stores. I vividly remember being astonished by the sound effects in Crystal Quest. Now I can't imagine how I played the game without muting it. Another big time sink was Glider. The levels were all rooms in a house, and they were really well illustrated. This one still gets ports from time to time, most recently an NES port by Retro USB.
Yeah,
I remember trying to figure out the story of the family that must live in the glider house. There are lots of little details that hint at lives being lived, but not enough to make many connections. Nice. I think the Spider games from Tiger Style took this concept and ran with it to incredible effect or to incredible results.
I think that's neat. Just a tangent for a second, that a child's mind imagines all kinds of things that aren't obviously there in the game. When I played Deadly Towers on the NES, there are all these windows in these buildings behind, and I always imagine what was in those windows and who lived there and stuff. But I would never think of that today. So
But yeah, actually, I added Glider to our list for later on, so we'll get to that. But Glider was a great
game. Glider was neat. It's tricky, but it's cool.
One from Christoset. Glad you're tackling black and white Mac gaming this week. For most of my childhood, I had only an NES and a Mac, so these games were very important to me. Dark Castle, along with its sequel Beyond Dark Castle, hasn't aged well from a gameplay perspective. The difficulty is based far too much on memorizing long sequences of time jumps, using incredibly stiff and awkward controls. But aesthetically, Dark Castle captured the best aspects of early Mac gaming. The backgrounds still look great and demonstrate how a skilled artist can create beautiful atmospheric environments with only black and white pixels. These were some of the first games that I played that emphasized freeform exploration, allowing the player to wander the castle's different areas in any order and even skip collecting crucial upgrades for a faster challenge. Falling into pits doesn't kill you, but instead drops you into a dungeon level, which adds to the sensation that the castle is a real space. And the games are really funny. The digitized sound samples make the hapless prince a legit cartoon character, gibbering when he walks into walls, yelping when he falls off a ledge, and grunting as he climbs a staircase. Taking the wrong key off a wall kills you instantly, but I would do it deliberately to see a 16-ton Looney Tunes weight drop on the prince's head. I would definitely recommend Retronauts listeners check out Dark Castle via archive.org's new System 6 browser emulator at archive.org/details/... I'll put this in the notes.
Just Google it.
jasonscott.internetarchive/jasonscott.
Thank you, letter writer. You just covered our next bullet point because that was it.
Let's talk a little bit more.
Absolutely. Dark Castle was great.
Just a couple more. Whoa, there's a really lengthy one. Okay, from a guy named Atari Spot. His parents were pretty crazy.
Whose weren't?
Well, I mean, my parents didn't name me Atari Spot. Okay. He sent me 10 early Mac gaming memories. I'm going to read two of them for games that we did not include in our notes. Actually, his top two here, Pararena by Soft Dorothy Software.
Wow.
Another great game eventually published by CNG. It was incredibly hard to play with a mouse, but the day we came home with a new Gravis mouse stick made this an instant classic. The sound effects and graphics, even in black and white, were fantastic. And I mean, riding a hoverboard while dunking on your opponent and checking them out of bounds. Who could ask for more? Challenging and fun. Never heard of this game.
Yeah, sure, I didn't make that up.
Okay. Oh, yeah, actually, what his number one game is in 1992. So let's look at his number three game, which is Falcon by Spectrum Holobank.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
I could not believe that a full-featured combat flight simulator was working on my Macintosh, yet there it was. I was making bombing runs and dogfighting so often, I remember naively telling classmates that, yes, I could fly an F-16. I mean, if I had to, probably.
Nice.
It's a cool game.
I didn't have that one, but I've seen it.
I think it originated on the PC, maybe. Falcon 3.0 or something.
Probably.
It had so many ports, so who knows what the first was.
So here's a letter from Norm, that's all caps. He talks about having a Mac Plus and feels like there weren't enough games on it. He says, do you guys maybe know why the Mac Plus was completely overlooked during that time? Was it because of its awesome color display, which consisted of black, white, gray, and even deeper black? It's odd because the Mac was honestly much more fit for gaming since it was sleek, responsive, and didn't require as much input as the average PC. Just double-click and you're good. Why was Mac gaming more of a niche?
I have an answer, which is that it had an innovative interface. It had the Wii U problem at first, which is that, if you have a whole generation of game developers trained to use a joystick or keyboard or something, you give them this new thing, it's much easier to port their games that they already know how to do than to develop new ideas that use this novel interface. And the Mac was like the touch interface of the day. It was very novel.
Took several years to really ramp up for people to get used to using this platform, like with any completely new platform, I would say.
Let's see, a letter from Tyler Burton. My dad encouraged me to learn about HyperCard, the foundational software behind these games, Cyan's games and others, and I gave a shot at creating my own linked rooms and experiences. Recently, I found out that my parents still had that very same Mac SE from my youth, so I took it home and found out that it still booted up and ran just like it was 1988. And to my surprise, I found a prophetic HyperCard stack that I made when I was probably 6 or 7. And I'll show you guys. It's a crudely drawn chunk of cheese, and above it says, cheese is good. And he ends the letter by saying, today, I run a cheese shop. Apparently, I just knew. I don't think we can top that.
So I told you HyperCard was great. It changes lives, man.
Yeah. Well, it's obvious that something I've always said about computers and games and why they're important to preserve is that they're very deep cultural experiences that are important cultural, you know, part of the recipe of what makes you who you are, your experiences as you grow up. So it's important to celebrate these things. Yeah, I mean, and that's what we're doing.
It's probably not an exaggeration to say HyperCard is why I have a master's in computer science now.
Yeah, there you go.
I can't account for my graphics design major, so I don't know. Oh, well, sure. Macintosh.
Why not? Macs are awesome.
Yeah. I remember drawing like that. Pictures of a bottle of whiteout on a Macintosh just because I was like, hey, I don't need to erase stuff on a Macintosh. I don't need whiteout. So let's go back to talking about some of the games.
Where are we at?
Next up is Dark Castle, which was mentioned in brief by one of our letters. But I think it deserves more discussion because it really was a sort of landmark game for the Mac and really commands a lot of... I don't know. I feel like it's a game with a lot of love behind it. Like people really remember it fondly. I missed out on it.
This is the first
I until I did research for this episode... Like, I didn't have a distinction in my head between Castle Wolfenstein and Dark Castle, but now I see that they're very, very totally different games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is the first one on our list that I actually owned at the time it came out, or at least
nearby. And you still own it.
And I still own it. Yeah, I actually wrote this game up for a GameSpot issue, like, half a decade ago or something.
And see, I edited it, and I probably was thinking Wolfenstein.
Yeah, that was not it at all.
Castle.
But, yeah, I mean, it's a very ambitious 2D platformer. With, you know, as our recurring theme here, gorgeous black and white graphics. So it had these big, well animated sprites and these incredibly gorgeous backgrounds. One screen at a time, but as our letter writer said, you could kind of choose where in this castle you went to. You could go to different, there were several different regions of the castle, and actually within each region, it kind of randomized the rooms, so you'd have a slightly different experience each time.
I mean, just kind of as an outsider perspective on this game, it seems to draw a lot of influence from. Honestly, from Donkey Kong, like I look and the platform elements. I mean, there's one screen where there's like an executioner guy throwing rocks that at you that tumbles.
There is a
like
very Donkey Kong-ish screen.
Then you go to the next screen and you're climbing vines and there's like birds that swoop down at you. I mean,
It draws
very
from
Donkey
a lot
Kong
of things.
Jr.
There's a Donkey Kong. There's some Donkey Kong stuff. But there's even some like Galaxian-ish stuff with the swooping birds.
Yeah.
It draws from a lot of things.
But another fundamental similarity, I think, is the idea of each screen being a self-contained challenge that you need to complete. And it even kind of plays around with space a little bit because there are some screens where instead of it just being like, you know, the screen is one square area, it's basically like an extended area, and you scroll to the end of the top half of the screen and you show up on the bottom half. It's like they've taken, you know, something that's two screens wide and half a screen tall and just stacked it on top of the other.
Yeah, there's some interesting like architecture.
But it does really get to that sort of classic adventure game, action game style concept. You'd see a lot in Prince of Persia or the Oddworld games even, where it's not so much, you know, like you're on a grand exploratory adventure, but more like you're solving this box of puzzles.
Yeah,
one
screen,
by one.
Each screen is very much its own thing to master. And you know, most screens have like some new enemy or some new mechanic that you have to use to go through. And lots of ways to die until you figure out how you're supposed to deal with that screen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very slow and deliberate platform. So you're not just like running around. You can throw rocks, but it's not like Mario where you're just running around.
Well, no, this is the crazy thing about the game is that it combines both keyboard controls and mouse controls.
Right. So your character movement is controlled keyboard, left, right, and jump, and up, down ladders and that stuff. But your attack is
aimed by the mouse.
Aimed
right?
by the aimed. You aim. You mouse aim. So you can move your arm arc, and you can. So this is another thing taking advantage of sort of the high resolution of this system.
I would say. Yeah, I'm confused by the popularity of this game, other than the fact that it's like you had to be there, kind of like the Dungeon of Doom, where Dungeon of Doom was the best you had. And I think of like Captain Comic on the IBM PC, which was like an incredible shareware Mario-like platformer. And it was just so awesome on the PC. But if you put it next to Mario or something, it just sucks. I mean, you know.
I
look at this game, and this game is contemporary with Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, and I said this when I wrote it up.
Like, this game
doesn't
stack up too badly to Super Mario Brothers. It's a different kind of experience.
It's very, very different. Yeah.
But, like, you know, visually and in, just in terms of all the things you were doing, it really, to me, this game feels a lot like some of the sort of action-adventure platformers you saw on Famicom in Japan, like Atlantis no Nazo or Challenger or something, where they were trying to create a bigger adventure. But this is much, much better put together. It also reminds me a lot of, you know, some of those Spectrum games you saw, like the Jet Set Willy type things. And this looks much better than those games and seems to me like it's probably a lot less frustrating. Challenging, but not as like...
It's still pretty frustrating, honestly.
It's very frustrating. But it is a unique experience. I'm not saying it's a Super Mario Brothers ripoff or anything like that. It's just...
It's a very different thing.
It's you just loved it if you had that on your Mac and that was your only game. I mean, people bought like one game a year or something back then, you know?
But yeah, I mean, it's so visually...
You played it and you loved it.
Visually and conceptually, it's very impressive. Like, the actual... game control, I would not necessarily try to defend to someone who wasn't there at the time. It's very slow. It's very touchy. You really have to want to like it in order to
deal
with how
this
character moves.
By the way, people are going to be so pissed that
that concept, that sort of like the weird sort of aiming approach, like you would see that in other games to a degree, like in Turrican. I feel like Treasure Games, kind of some like Gunstar Heroes and stuff, try to explore that within the context of a console game. And then, of course, you had Abuse, developed by Crack.com and published by Bungie in the late 90s. That was literally the same thing. Like, it was a Turrican-style shooter where you could aim independently with the mouse as you ran around with a keyboard.
Yeah. Like, and I think about this, like, compared to, like, console games, like, because you had this high-resolution screen and this very precise mouse input, they made it so you can, you know, you can aim in very small increments. Which is cool, but it also makes it very easy to like just miss things.
Yeah.
You're not just going up, down, and diagonally. Mm-hmm. You're going in all these different possible directions, and so you're shooting at some bat halfway across the screen. You can throw 10 rocks and whiff every one of them, and that can get frustrating.
I mean, the game was very generous with its supply of rocks. So
yeah,
of
rocks.
It's a game about rocks.
There's a lot of rocks in the game.
Throwing rocks.
Yeah,
but it's neat.
Yeah, hang on one sec.
It's a cool game. It has a It's culturally important. It was great for its time, and it obviously has a lot of endearing qualities, like the animations and sounds that were unique and special. So that's.
But yeah, I would not claim to anyone that it's not hard to get into. Getting the hang of the controls takes some investment, and even then, it's not an easy game. Like, you have to figure out each screen, and even when you did, the execution is not always easy.
Yeah, but I mean, that's probably true for most games of this era, especially the ambitious ones. Like, I wouldn't recommend that someone who's never played an NES game jump into the original Zelda or Metroid, because they're going to be like, wow, I want to stab my eyeball.
and it was an era when you weren't, downloading a new game every week. You know, you spent money on this game, and there's 14 screens in this game. Mm-hmm. They're all gorgeous, but if you just ran through them, it would be over in, two minutes. So
imagine the 80s. You're trapped in a room with one computer with one game for like 6 months. And
right,
you have to play that. You can't talk to anybody about it other than through writing mail.
Yeah, you send a letter to the editor.
It's a different era.
You would actually practice the individual screens of this to figure them out and figure out how you wanted to deal with them. And in that context, it's not so bad. If you pick it up now and try to run through it, you're going to have a bad time.
So at the opposite end of this, I'd like to talk about Stunt Copter, a game that's almost barely qualifies as a game, but I still have fond memories of it because it's just so goofy. Like, this was on one of my computers at the computer lab when I was a kid, and everyone wanted to play it because it's super accessible and a little bit macabre. But you're just like, you have a helicopter and there's a cart of hay being pulled across the bottom of the screen. And there's a little guy hanging from the helicopter, and you choose where you fly to, and then you drop the guy, and he goes kicking and flailing as he drops, and you try to land on the hay. It's like Assassin's Creed, the prequel. And if you miss, then oh god, you miss.
We should talk about shareware in general for a second, because that's not so much of a thing right now. So maybe not all our listeners are familiar.
That's true. I think of shareware as more of a '90s thing, but I guess it was '80s too.
Stunt Copter was '86, and it was very much shareware. So shareware was basically the 80s and 90s version of, here, you can just have this, but please support my Patreon kind of deal, really, back when the internet was a much much less of a thing. So you could get these, I mean, if you had internet in the 90s, you could download them, but you could also send off for discs that just had shareware on
them. You're talking about BBSs.
Or you could get them off BBSs. You could get them off dial. Yeah, you could get them off dial on BBSs sometimes. But basically, these would be small games produced by, you know, indie developers, although we didn't even really have that term then, but just dudes they were writing just,
yeah,
things.
It was like a person making people, a video game and not working at a major publisher.
So they would mostly just be these little things, and it would be like, here's the full game, you can play it. If you like it, please literally send me in the mail, you know, $5 or something. Mm-hmm. And that was how they work. And of course, most people wouldn't, but some people would. And so, you know, some people would make a little bit of money off
of this. We should do a whole episode on shareware stuff, because I've done a lot of writing about the history
of
that.
Yeah, sure, that would be fascinating.
But this was definitely a big thing on Macs in the late 80s and early 90s. Mm-hmm. And so this stunt capture, you know, it's a very simple little thing. All it is one mechanic, and you just try to do it and get a high score. And so, yeah, it was a little shareware thing.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, it's kind of a precursor to Angry Birds almost. You're just doing one thing over and over again.
Yeah.
But even more limited, because it's just one copter and one hay cart.
Yeah. And so actually that's also a good comparison. Game. It's very much that era's version of the free to play, except because they weren't internet enabled, you couldn't have microtransactions. So it was just, you know, pretty please pay me something was how it worked.
Yeah, people don't even know what microtransactions are anymore. That's something from like 2002.
Well, so
everything is a microtransaction.
Everything is now.
Yeah, but they don't know that term anymore.
You did not have in-app purchases because you probably weren't even connected to the internet. And even if you were, these shareware games certainly didn't have netcode. So yeah, it was just, here's my cool thing. If you like it, send me some money. And some people did.
So maybe a little tangentially related to that is the next game, Shanghai. Not that Shanghai itself was shareware, but it did inspire a lot of like freeware and shareware clones.
Definitely.
And Shanghai, if people out there have been following Game Boy Works and the other sort of Game Boy retrospectives I've been doing, then you've seen Shanghai, because it was a staple of Game Boy, not only this game, but also the mini clones. Like,
many versions.
For some reason, For whatever reason, it kind of like created this weird microgenre of other games with a similar concept, also named after a Chinese territory. So far in Game Boy Works, I've covered Shanghai, and also Hong Kong, and also Shishensho, which is Japanese for Sichuan. So,
Taiwan.
So like all of these games are about, and I haven't been to Taiwan, haven't gotten there yet, but probably there's one up in the future.
I wouldn't be surprised.
But all these games are about matching Mahjong tiles. And Shanghai was the original. It came out for Mac and Amiga in 1986. It was designed by a guy named Brody Lockard, who I've read was a gymnast who became crippled in an accident. I think he became paraplegic. And so he became more focused on developing video games. And he worked on this and also a game we'll talk about briefly later, Ishido.
Yeah, I read that it started on the Plato system, that educational network game system in the early 80s. That's what I read about Shanghai originally. But somehow he came back and did it for Activision.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it became like an actually published game. And it's like the American version of Mahjong, which means to say it has nothing to do with Mahjong. But it uses Mahjong tiles. And you just have a stack of tiles. And you can only move pieces that are not blocked, either on the sides or above.
Yeah, so it's a mountain of tiles.
Yeah.
So you have to dig through
everything. And you have to match the edges. But you're trying to, basically, there are like, I think, four tiles, maybe it's eight tiles, I can't remember, that share the same symbol on them. It's like, you know, which Chinese symbols for 1 through 9, and then like seasons,
the
and then there's an illustration. Yeah.
Basically, this is to Mahjong as solitaire is to poker.
Basically, yeah.
You're using that deck, but you're just playing a matching game.
And it's really easy to cruise along until you get to the very end, and it's very easy to accidentally sort of lock yourself into a way where you can't actually make a match and you lose the game.
Similar to if you're playing solitaire, like Klondike.
That reminds me, I grew up with this Shanghai game, I was like, then they called it Mahjong. I was like, yeah, I know Mahjong. So I played like Mahjong for the Famicom. I was like, what the heck is this?
No, that's a completely weird game.
No.
So I had, so I didn't actually have Shanghai. I actually had one of the shareware knockoffs, which was Gunshy. I have no idea why it was called Gunshy.
Shanghai, Gunshy. Yeah. It's like, okay, like mixing up the, yeah.
Offensive, the stereotypical.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And it, yeah, it had like terrible icons. But this leads into one of the other things I wanted to mention, which was, the ability of to edit Mac games. So like one of the, you know, one of the things about Mac is how it's this like lockdown perfect system, but there were also a lot of like hacker type people working on Mac, like Woz and so on. And so one of the things that came with Macs was this little utility called ResEdit, which stands for resource editor.
Right. It's important to mention that Mac files had this format where there was like the data fork and the resource fork.
Right. Yeah.
So, and the resource was stuff like icons and images.
Man,
and
I hate
like
resource fork.
And so all the, yeah. So it causes tons of problems if you want to move all Mac stuff to a different file system, because the file system was actually oriented around all your executables having
bunch
these
of forks. It's like about silverware and stuff. Cutlery. Right. It's a cutlery system.
So it causes
system.
All kinds of problems. But this was the standard for Mac for all through its early, I mean, up until like OS X, right?
Yeah,
up until OS X.
And OS X still has some weird crap going on, doesn't it?
Yeah, but maybe. It doesn't have the resource
but
forks.
But you can still... But anyways, it's like embedded.
So every standard program, every program that was put together in
they're
the standard
like
way had
packages
this...
Now.
Yeah, now you just have packages. And it's more uniform across different platforms. But this was a Mac-only thing at the time, and every standard program had all its graphics and synapses and stuff in this resource fork. So ResEdit was a program that actually, I think, was just came with the system, or if not, you can install it off the utility disk.
Yeah, I think it was on the utilities disk. I don't think it was meant to be like for mere mortals.
Yeah,
it was people
who
actually took the time to dig around.
But it was there. You could get it. So this was, I mean, this was sort of how the Mac worked. It was, you know, the out-of-the-box system was just, you didn't need to touch it. It was just supposed to work. But if you wanted, there were people, you know, making these things that were hackers, and they knew you would want stuff, and they put it there. So you could get this ResEdit off the utility disk and just open the resource for of any program. So something like Gunshy, which is just has all these icons for tiles, you go in with ResEdit and there are all your icons, you can just replace them. So suddenly you have a version that you can make a version of Shanghai with whatever stupid tiles you want. And oh lord,
I made Simpsons
was a big, so people sometimes people would do this and then redistribute it as their own thing version. So the Simpsons version
of Gunshy
was very big. It just had basically little, you know, 16 pixel icons of Simpsons characters as all the tiles. But you could go in and make your own, and I made some
it's
really
easier
stupid
that way
versions
too.
Of Gunshy.
If you can, you know, if you're not familiar with those the Chinese characters and the
you can make things
tiles,
more recognizable.
It's so much easier to play.
And you could do this with a lot of games. I mean, the more complicated games, sometimes it would, you know, it wouldn't be so straightforward, because if you had got to something that had weird textures or whatever, but something that just was based on icons. You know, later on I had a version of Puyo Puyo for Mac that, you know, people know Puyo Puyo. It's just little blobs, and I replaced the blobs with so many different things.
Did you replace them with Kirby or Sonic characters?
I don't think I ever had Kirby. I did, like, weird
versions. Nintendo did.
Nintendo did. That's true.
Jelly Bean?
Or the Jelly Bean version or the Yoshi version or
like
cookies or...
Dr. Robotnik's... But,
yeah, Mean Bean Machine was straight up Puyo Puyo.
Yeah,
people did this for real.
Me.
But no, I had a version where one of the colors of Puyo was invisible. That was evil.
Sounds not very nice.
Yeah. It wasn't very nice at all. I like sprung this on my college roommates.
Impossible.
It was great.
Puyo.
It was totally playable if you knew what you were doing. Anyways, I digress. But yeah, so there were a lot of versions of Shanghai, particularly because it was so easy to make new versions. Mm-hmm.
All right, we're kind of running low on time, so we're going to blitz through a few more notable titles. One of them I'd like to talk about, but I don't really feel like I'm qualified, is The Fool's Errand, which is an adventure game by Cliff Johnson. And I have read through the years many people talking about how amazing this game was, but I've never played it myself, so it's really hard to say. Is this something you've played, Ben?
I have not actually played it. I didn't have it when it came out. I've looked at it later.
I think this was... It's sort of obscure because I've heard many great things about it.
People who've played
it's a cult game.
I don't have a copy of it. You know, I've bought people's Mac disc collections and stuff, and never was there a copy of The Fool's Errand in there.
Like,
you
it's
know?
Essentially, it's essentially
common.
Like, it's a set of puzzles, but it's also kind of a visual novel. Like, it has this story running through.
It's a story
it.
Of, like, a fool who is on a
on
quest.
On an errand. Trying to get some bread from the store.
Yeah.
So there's this very... I mean, and this was another... So, like I was talking about before, the Macintosh attracted people who were not traditional game designers. So this was one of those things.
Oh, yeah.
Where, like, the person who made it was not at all a
Cliff
games person.
Johnson.
Yeah, it's another Cliff Johnson one. But they were bringing to this, basically, you know, graphics and literature, and making that into a game by putting some puzzles in it, essentially. So you have this whole story, but to unlock the story, you have to do these puzzles. You know, in a way, it's almost like Professor Layton these days, where you have basically just a story, but then there's puzzles you do to get through it. Although in this one, the puzzles are arguably a lot better integrated than in Professor Layton. It's not just like, oh, this reminds me of a puzzle, but rather you have to do this to get from this area to this area. Or like the answer to the puzzle reveals something about the next chapter of the story.
It is Layton-esque in that if you get stuck on something, that's not, you know, like you haven't hit a wall for the game. You can duck out of that puzzle.
Go a different way. Yeah,
there are all kinds of things. There's like jigsaw puzzles and rebuses and word puzzles and just there's a huge variety of things.
I remember something about the Fool's Errand back in 2007. There's something called the Game Canon being developed by the IGDA and stuff, and I was asked to participate in that. And Steve Moretzky, I think, you know, one of the Infocom guys who worked on Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, among other games.
Yeah.
And he listed the Fool's Errand as one of his favorite PC games of all time.
I think that makes sense.
So that's a pretty heady, you know, pretty good endorsement, I think, from a legendary adventure designer.
No, it's very highly regarded. And this is another one. There's a great article on the Digital Antiquarian that people should check out. It really goes into the history of it. And I think the guy who runs the site, Jimmy Mayer, actually interviewed Cliff Johnson about the game. So there's a lot of insights into kind of his life, you know, beyond just the game. So it's a great read. I recommend everyone check it out. I'll put it in the show notes. Ben just really determined to talk about Crystal Quest.
I kind of want to talk about Crystal Quest.
All right, guys,
Crystal Quest
is
something special.
Crystal Quest was great. It's almost
so
like
that's with Bentley the Bear, right?
No,
I'm kidding.
You have this little crystal flying around. It's almost a proto Twin Stick.
The Crystal Mansion.
I think of it.
Bentley's right. Sir Bentley the Bear.
So I kind of think of this as a proto Twin Stick shooter, except it's only one stick.
Yeah.
Like, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I get it. Yeah. So, like Robotron with a mouse. Yeah.
So you have this little crystal spaceship, this little spaceship, and you're flying it around this little square. So and shooting at things.
And it has momentum and it's all
wonky. It has momentum.
And
that's
stuff.
The thing that's weird. Yeah. So your mouse, you use
it's
your
like
mouse.
It's like Space War with a mouse.
Right. No. You entirely use your mouse, but your mouse position does not correspond one to one to the ship. You're not just putting the ship somewhere, you're using the mouse to impart momentum.
Yeah.
Which is really like Space War with a mouse.
Yeah, it's Space War. It is Space War with a mouse.
Not quite, because you can... I mean, you stop and it stops eventually. It just slows down.
There's drag.
It's not like it'll just keep going forever.
You really have to play it to get a feel for the physics of it. But it's a really unique thing. And it had interesting
sounds. So you gather crystals and you shoot things at the same time.
Yeah, you're trying to basically... You don't actually have to clear out the enemies because what you're really trying to do is pick up all the crystals and then escape.
Yeah, without
but you end up needing to shoot with the enemies to do it. But
you're avoiding things, your little ship, with avoiding the enemies, shooting them from different directions based on where you point your mouse while you click the button.
Yeah, you always shoot in the direction you're moving, which is why it's a single.
And then don't you have to navigate through a tiny little?
You have to get through a little exit portal
when you
collect the crystals.
When you do that, it gives you this weird orgasm noise. I noticed.
Yeah,
it's like, what's going on there?
That's because sex is exactly like this game, Crystal Quest. Yeah,
you're pointing in the wrong direction.
Did Netcher work on this game? I don't think so. But it's just
there's a lot of momentum involved
and drag.
And another interesting thing about this
and
game
mice.
Is...
mice. Right, guys?
Anyway.
Okay. But the other interesting thing is one of the later versions of it came with its own enemy editor.
You didn't even have to use res edit.
You didn't even have to use res edit. So you could construct your own enemies and their behaviors and stuff. So that was another cool thing about it.
That was probably in the color era. The color version.
Get ported to color. Yeah, the original was black and white, but it definitely got updated to color.
And a Game Boy Color port, which is weird as heck. I put a scan of that on Vintage.
Yeah, it was apparently ported to Game Boy. I didn't actually know that before I looked it up.
Bentley gets around.
If you look it up, you'll probably get Vintage Computing Retro Scan of the Week Crystal Quest on Game Boy.
I'm going to do it. Speaking of color, we should talk about Solarian 2, the very first Mac game made exclusively for color systems.
This one I had.
Which didn't show up until 1988. That's how long it took for Max to finally say, okay, color.
Yeah, it's like one of those overlapping platform situation where the Color Mac came out, but a lot of people still had black and white Macs. So if you put out something, you want a lot of people to play.
People were using the SE30 until 1995.
Yeah, yeah,
and that was black and white on for
a long time. But so it took a little while for people to even be willing to put out stuff that was only color exclusive. You know, there were a lot of things.
Plus, higher resolution,
and it was a higher resolution. Yeah.
Some games still were like color, but a smaller window.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. If you had something that really took advantage of the whole Mac 2, then it absolutely couldn't play on any of the other ones. So that was a problem. So a lot of games had, you know, their original black and white version and their color port.
Yeah, I remember Solarian. It's a shooter, right?
It was very kind of Galaxian-esque, but the patterns were weird.
The patterns were fantastic.
And I mainly remember it because I played it and I was like, oh, I recognize that sound effect. Oh, and I know where they took that one from.
It's not the orgasm sound effect.
It's the cash register from Pink Floyd's Money. And then there's from Peter Gabriel, something in there.
Yeah, yeah, there was all kinds of stuff in there. But so this had, like, you know, amazing graphics for the time. These cool, I mean, they're actually not that great if you go back and look to them, but just having everything in all color at the time was cool.
Yeah, it was another one of those games that was very Macintosh-ish because of its extremely high resolution. Like, the sprites were very tiny.
So this was formatted exactly for the Mac 2. It took up the whole screen, which gave you a ton of space for something that was basically like a Space Invaders Galaxian.
It was like taking, you know, NES or arcade sprites and putting them in, you know, twice the resolution. Space. So you had a ton of sprites on the screen, but it was also very tricky to shoot things because you were shooting tiny little bullets, tiny little things.
But it did these really cool things for the time. So instead of just having, game, like, we? These ranks.
It was good.
We should talk about the Mac 2 for
like,
a minute.
Instead of just having, like, you know, these ranks of enemies, you had these formations, like there would be a set of like 16 enemies that were flying in a square shape, but then the square would like rotate and fly around the screen, and you had these incredibly wacky formations.
And it was done in HyperCard.
What?
No. Don't listen to him.
Could I do it in HyperCard?
Yeah, the Mac 2 came out in 87, I think, the SE, same year as SE. I did a big article on that too, Macintosh 2, some kind of anniversary article. And it was amazing because I interviewed one of the engineers behind it, and they're like, we want to go back and make an Apple II with a Mac, you know, with slots, and you could do anything you want, expand it however you want. It's an open box, you know, and you could put, like, it had, I think the original had what, like 5 slots or something, and you could put 5 video cards in there and extend the desktop to like all 5 of them. In 1987, you could get 24-bit color. You could get all kinds of crazy stuff. It costs like $200,000 to do that.
Ridiculous, yeah.
But you could do it. I mean, it was incredible.
Yeah, I think that sort of eventually evolved into the Quadra line, which was sort of the high-end, super high-end, customizable open box version, as opposed to, like, the SE kind of turned into the Performa, the SE.
This was
like
the beginning of that era where one of the niches that Apple went over was the people who want the absolute, you know, most graphics you could have on your desk.
Yeah, that was a kick-ass machine.
Through the next decade.
Now they don't have anything, like, computer-wise, so they just buy Teslas.
Yeah.
Going to wrap this up. Let's talk about
Teslas.
Two last games.
Okay. Yeah.
The first is Scarab of Ra, which is I remember playing as a kid, and it's kind of like a roguelike combined with a first-person adventure. So it's like it's basically an ICOM game combined with the Dungeon of Doom, more or less. It's a first-person adventure. You're clicking through, kind of scrolling, you know, wizardry style, but each level, you know, each playthrough is randomly generated. So you're in a pyramid, and it's a 9-level pyramid. And each pyramid, you're descending, so it gets bigger and bigger as you descend. So you start out, it's 3x3 screens. And then you go down a level, it's 4x4, and then 5x5, et cetera, et cetera. So the further you get into the game, the more complex it becomes. And, you know, like I said, it's always randomized. There's stamina, you have health, and you have a hunger element. So you have to find food, you have to find oil for your lantern, so you're not plunged into darkness and a grue eats you. There's a lot going on here.
Yeah.
It was a shareware game, wasn't it?
Was it?
Yeah, I think it was.
I thought it was a commercial release.
I didn't have this one when it came out.
It was by Semicolon Software, but I don't know if it was
shareware. I think it was shareware. It was kind of dinky for, you know, a commercial game, but it was awesome for a shareware game.
I don't know. It's a pretty substantial game.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it was impressive.
Down to the bottom of a 9-level pyramid, and it's totally randomized, and you're finding 3 treasures. I mean, it's got
that
kind of...
That's pretty big.
It's got that kind of, you know, that definite, like, rogue net hack. You're searching for a treasure, and then you can either escape, or you can keep fighting and... hope you don't die against the Guardian.
And I really feel like
it's hard.
I said, I didn't play this at the time when it came out, but looking at it now, I really wonder if this was an inspiration for one of the things we probably talk about in the sequel to this episode, Pathways into Darkness, because that has a lot of similarities.
Pathways didn't have the randomization.
No, it didn't have the randomization, but just in terms of the mechanics and the look of it. Mm-hmm. So Pathways being one of Bungie's early games, which we'll get to in later Mac games.
Talk about that in the 90s episode.
Yep.
And finally, just to kind of bring things full circle, I'd like to talk about Shufflepuck Cafe.
Yeah.
Which is a 1989 game developed by Broderbund, whatever, mm-hmm. and kind of loops back to Alice.
It's
the same perspective. It's a real-time game driven with a mouse, but instead of being like a chess simulation kind of thing, it's more like air hockey.
It's air hockey, yeah. So I had this one. This one was cool. So it had this little kind of over-the-shoulder perspective air hockey table, but then at the other end of the table, you had these high-res sprites of your opponents. And the cool thing about this game is you were actually playing against characters. And these characters really had characters. So kind of in the vein of something a lot of Retronauts people probably have played, Punch-Out, you had a bunch of characters that all had their own personalities, their own tells, their own play styles. Uh-huh. So like the first person you played, there was this sci-fi theme, so they were all weird aliens. And like the first one you played them was, you know, this terrible player, and they were really nervous. And their paddle would like... vibrate because they were jittery because they were nervous, and then
that's cool.
And you'd have one later that like there was a player that started out really good, but they were drinking and they would get worse as the game went on because they were getting drunk.
That's amazing. That's just like a podcast.
Yeah, it is like
it's
this
like
gin,
like
this gin Jeremy gave
shuffle
me,
gin.
Which is probably why I'm so enthusiastic about these games because of Jeremy's gin. And there was like, you know, there was an Esper who would like use psychokinesis on the puck to cheat. And like, and a bunch of these characters, you know, there were these big animated sprites, so they'd have tells sometimes when they were going to do something. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it lent a lot to the game beyond just being basically Pong, you know, which is what air hockey is. But so it's 3D Pong, but it has all this character to it, which made it really cool.
I've never played the Mac version of this, but I think it's the original, isn't it?
The Shufflepuck is the original.
Yeah, I think it started on Mac.
Yeah,
I think so.
Okay, I remember also this is, you know, speaking of Steve Moretzky, this is another one of his favorite games. Just, I remember that.
Nice.
Because he was into really cool, obscure games that were really neat.
It was ported, I don't think Shufflepuck Cafe is that obscure.
Yeah,
it was published
by Broderbund.
It's obscure just in the broad spectrum of things.
Well,
I mean, compared to like Super
Doom,
Mario Brothers.
Sure.
But for a 1989 Mac first game,
it was great. Well, I was actually, I did an article about the greatest PC games of all time or something in 2009. And I surveyed a bunch of developers, and he was like the guy. Moretzky was the guy who mentioned these neat Mac games.
Yeah,
and that
sounds like a lot of fun.
Interesting. Yeah.
All right, so that's basically the 80s for Mac gaming. We skipped over a few titles, but I think that's a pretty good rundown. And we could definitely go on. And certainly, if we wanted to delve into the 90s, that could be another couple of hours.
Yeah, 90s
so,
way different.
Yeah, so I think what we're going to do is save the 90s discussion for another episode.
Got all kinds of stuff for there.
Yeah, there'll be plenty to talk about. And we'll wrap this one up. So thanks, guys. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I hope you learned some interesting things about Macs. And definitely check out archive.org's System 6 emulator, which is good for, should be good for any game made before 1990.
Most of these should run on
System 7 was what, like 91?
Sounds about right.
Yeah,
something
I have
like
System
that.
7 discs that are like 92, and that was 7 point something.
7.1,
so,
yeah.
7.2 or something.
Yeah. So that should pretty much allow you to play all of these games. And again, like if you can find them in the wild, God bless, but it's really hard to play classic Mac games, not only because of the fragility of the media, but also because the Macintosh platform has gone through so many platforms or through so many revisions. Like, it's not that hard to run DOSBox and play old DOS games, but Macs are much more difficult because you had, you know, the move to color, you had the move from the 68040 architecture to PowerPC, going from CISC to RISC. You had the transition from classic Mac OS to OS X, where it jumped from like a custom bespoke operating system to a Unix-based system. Yeah. And then you had the jump from
Intel.
RISC to Intel.
Yep.
So you lose things, over to this
things at every step.
There is a great Mac emulator called vMac that's small and simple, and it emulates a Mac Plus era computer. Yeah.
There are some emulators, and a few of these things were actually ported up. So like Solarian 2 got an OS X port. That worked, but it didn't get an Intel port.
Yeah.
So, like, for some of those, you can still
And I read about that, and the source code is lost. So
they lost the source code.
So they have to build it from the ground up.
Yeah, playing PowerPC games today, Mac games, very tough. Yeah. Very tricky.
Yep.
Yeah, so so it's definitely difficult. You can emulate to a certain degree, but it's still pretty tough. So I would say if you're interested, just play the games somehow.
It's every man for themselves. Just do whatever you can to survive.
It's a lawless hell out there.
Yeah.
The black and white stuff emulates pretty well, but it can be a little tricky getting, you know, the right, because there are different resolutions for different eras, and so you got to be careful with what your setup is.
But definitely worth it, because it is a very unique slice of gaming, and it's one that I only intersected with briefly just because of not having much access to Macs, but it's still like those old graphics just stand out of my mind because they're so distinct, and the game concepts that came into being, even if they were sort of familiar genres, they still always put unique spins on things. So it's a great little platform, definitely worth exploration.
It's an era with some really beautiful stuff that you just don't see anymore because no one does, you know, 1-bit designs.
Game Boy was 2-bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, thanks everyone for listening. For Retronauts, this has been Jeremy Parrish. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. You can find me at Retronauts.com. You can find Retronauts at Retronauts.com also. On iTunes, on the Podcast One Network, and so on and so forth. We are, of course, supported by Patreon in addition to those advertisements because we're greedy and we like money and I like being able to eat. And this is my living now, so please help. A poor young podcaster. Actually, I'm not that young.
and anyway, if you have any money left over, you know, I do a Patreon thing too. Patreon.com/BengeEdwards. You know, I'm just a guy Jeremy pulled in off the street to talk about the Mac.
Yeah.
BengeEdwards.com, Twitter.com/BengeEdwards/BengeEdwards ad infinitum.
Yep.
I don't have a Patreon. Sorry.
Think about it. Just for the hell of it.
But I do have a Twitter. I'm Kirinn, K-I-R-I-N-N, on Twitter. And I actually just started up a new Tumblr for stuff related to this, which will probably have content on it by the time this episode actually goes out.
What is that one called?
It is Kirinn's Retro Closet. Sorry, there's only one N in Kirinn this time, because that's the way I like it better. I just couldn't get that on Twitter. So Kirinn's Retro Closet, all one word, .tumblr.com. And I'm going to, because... It's called that because I actually literally just cleaned out my childhood closets from my parents' houses and got a lot of stuff related to the stuff we're talking about.
To me.
Some of which I'm giving to Benj because Benj will make better uses of it than I have, being a retro computing expert. But I'm going to start putting up some photos and stuff on there. So we may have stuff related to these episodes too. So you can check that out.
All right. Thanks, guys. And that's it. So we'll be back next week with...
something else.
Yeah, let's do a Retronauts Radio next week. I'm going to mix up the order a little bit. And we'll be back again with another Retronauts East in about a month-ish, because why not? So stay tuned. We'll be back to talk at you more.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.